This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Russian forces on Thursday launched massive missile strikes on Ukraine's Kyiv and Chernihiv regions, areas that have not been targeted in weeks, while Ukrainian officials announced an operation to liberate an occupied region in the country's south. VOA contributor Anna Chernikova tells us that the Ukrainians in almost every region woke up very early to the sounds of the missile strikes.
Because starting from 4 a.m., air raid sirens were on in many different regions. What we know from the official sources by the Ukrainian officials that more than 20 missiles were launched by Russian forces on the territory of Ukraine, and they were from three directions. So basically, Kalibr missiles came from Black Sea, Iskander's missiles came from the Homel region in Belarus, and X-22 missiles from 222 aircraft came from the territory of Russia.
Meanwhile, the Kremlin warns a possible prisoner swap with the U.S. involving American basketball star Brittney Griner must be negotiated behind the scenes.
As the basketball player Brittney Griner's trial in Russia continues, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov is warning a possible prisoner swap needs to be moved along quietly, without fanfare. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Washington had offered Russia a deal that would bring home Griner and another jailed American, Paul Whelan. A person familiar with the matter says the proposed exchange involves convicted Russian arms dealer Victor Boot, once labeled the merchant of death. I'm Charles Villadesma.
And this is VOA News. U.S. President Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping spoke for more than 2 hours on Thursday amid rising tensions between their two nations. The call began at 8:33 in the morning and ended at 10:50 a.m. It is the fifth talk of their presidencies and their first since March, shortly after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Relations between the two countries have been strained by talk of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's potential trip to Taiwan. That island governs itself, but China considers it part of its territory. John Kirby, spokesman for the National Security Council, told reporters on Wednesday that it's important that the lines of communication with President Xi remain open. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un reportedly is threatening to use his nuclear weapons in potential military conflicts with the United States and South Korea. AP correspondent Donna Water with more.
The official Korean Central News Agency is reporting that Kim unleashed fiery rhetoric against rivals he says are pushing the Korean Peninsula to the brink of war. In a speech to war veterans, Kim accused the U.S. of demonizing North Korea to justify its hostile policies, and he called the U.S. gangster-like for carrying out U.S.-South Korea military drills targeting North Korea, but blasting the North's military activities, an apparent reference to its missile tests. Observers say while Kim is increasingly threatening his rivals with nuclear weapons, it's unlikely he would use them first against the superior militaries of the U.S. and its allies. I'm Donna Water.
The U.N. Security Council has unanimously condemned Myanmar's executions of four political prisoners and called for an immediate halt to all forms of violence and full respect for human rights and the rule of law. That statement, approved by all 15 council members, noted Myanmar had hanged the men after the Association of Southeast Asian Nations appealed for the sentences to be reconsidered. ASEAN has been leading global efforts to bring peace to Myanmar since the military takeover, but the bloc said this week the execution set back its efforts to facilitate some type of dialogue. Japan's push to obtain UNESCO World Heritage for former gold mine key to the nation's industrialization will be delayed. The Sato Island mine in northern Japan operated for nearly 400 years and was one of the world's largest gold producers before closing in 1989, but the efforts to obtain UNESCO listing have added to diplomatic frictions with South Korea. There is more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehias Uhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And a dollar spent on preparedness is worth $1,000 spent on response.
That is Mike Ryan, the WHO Executive Director for Health Emergencies, on the need to pay more attention to pandemic preparedness. Details coming up also. The World Health Organization is calling for greater investment in the development of new vaccines. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. First, our top story. Mali's military government says coordinated insurgent attacks killed 15 troops and 3 civilians yesterday, while leaving scores of militants dead. Analysts say the attacks show increasing insecurity in the West African country following the withdrawal of French forces. Annie Rosenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
The attacks were launched Wednesday against military targets in Mopti, a city in central Mali, as well as in Sokolo and Kalumba, also in central Mali. The Malian army issued a statement saying it neutralized 48 militants. The statement was read by Ibrahima Dembele, presenter for Mali's national TV and radio station ORTM.
L'état-major général des armées rassure les Maliens et appelle les observateurs.
The chief of staff of the armed forces reassures Malians and calls on observers not to be deceived by the recent acts of an adversary losing momentum, he says. According to the analysis of the chief of staff, he says, the recent attacks, which confirm signals and clues previously detected and identified by us, show the final throes of armed terrorist groups on our territory. Foji Tanjigora, a sociology professor at the University of Bamako and researcher on security in Mali for several organizations, said via a messaging app from Bamako that despite such assurances, the situation in Mali is getting worse and has entered a new phase in which Islamist militants are able to better organize and carry out simultaneous planned attacks. Militants also launched a series of attacks last week in several localities before attacking Kati, a town just 15 kilometers from Bamako and home to the army's main military base. Tanjigora says these attacks are meant to send a message.
C'est un message, non seulement à l'endroit de l'opinion publique.
It's a message, he says, not only towards public opinion, but also and especially to the international community, to say that ultimately the Malian army, contrary to the impression which has been conveyed by them, do not have the ability to maintain security on Malian territory. Insecurity has been mounting in Mali in recent months as the French army completes the process of withdrawing from the country. French President Emmanuel Macron is currently visiting several countries in West Africa, where France continues to send military support to certain countries in the fight against extremism. The French army was primarily active in Mali's north. Macron announced the withdrawal of troops in February, following increasing tensions with Mali's military government and concerns about the government working with Russian mercenaries. Reports of mercenaries committing human rights abuses have been published by Human Rights Watch and several international media outlets since March. Tanjigora says that public opinion in Mali is widely in favor of a Russian intervention, which many hope can end the country's rampant insecurity. He says that though Mali maintains that it only works with official Russian instructors, whether official soldiers or mercenaries, the presence of these soldiers has had little effect on the security situation. Tanjigora also says that the state is failing to address widespread misinformation circulating on social networks, which has contributed to increasing tensions in the country. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
French President Emmanuel Macron talked with Guinea-Bissau's President Umaro Sissoko Embalo about the risks of destabilization posed by countries in the Sahel region on the rest of West Africa as he wrapped up a three-country Africa tour. Macron told a news conference after meeting with Embalo, who is the current chair of the regional economic bloc ECOWAS, that he reiterated France's determination, first of all, to remain committed to the Sahel and the region, adding that France, he said, could come to support armies with training and equipment and joint missions. Macron also pledged funding for education and economic development, as well as military support to fight extremism in West and Central Africa. West Africa is facing security challenges with increased extremist attacks and several coups and attempted power grabs since August 2020. In brief remarks, Mbalo welcomed Macron's support and said, "We are confronted with terrorism not just in the Sahel region, but all of Africa is confronted with this scourge." In the Democratic Republic of Congo, four people protesting against the United Nations peacekeeping mission were electrocuted yesterday in the city of Uvira when troops fired shots which hit an electric cable that fell on them, according to the mission. On Tuesday, at least 12 civilians were killed in protests against UN peacekeepers in the DRC. What's driving anti-UN sentiment in that country? Voice Carol asked that question to Paul Nanutilia, a research specialist with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies and a former elections observer in the DRC.
There's a lot of frustration within the DRC, and this goes way back. There's a lot of frustration. We came across this during a previous negotiation that I was involved with about the different peacekeeping missions that have been deployed in the country. The UN has, UN peacekeepers have been deployed in the Congo from the 1960s in different forms, right? MONUSCO is just the latest, but UN peacekeepers have been involved in that country from the crisis that erupted after the first prime minister was killed at independence. And there's a sense among the Congolese that the United Nations peacekeeping troops have not been effective in stabilizing the country and in giving the country a fresh start.
What about those complaints? Do you think that they are true?
Well, I think the Congolese people do have a point in the sense that when you deploy a peacekeeping mission, there are a number of things that you need to do. One of those is to look at the essentially expectations, how the local community perceive peacekeepers. They perceive peacekeepers to be soldiers that are deployed to pacify the country, to fight rebellions, to bring rebellions to an end, to protect civilians from ambushes, from rebel attacks. Essentially, they view peacekeepers the way that civilians would normally perceive government forces in terms of what government forces are supposed to do. Now, there might be an over-exaggeration in terms of that perception, but it's a perception. And, perception sometimes becomes reality. Congolese cities have fallen to rebels before. In the presence, this is not the first time that Congolese are demonstrating against peacekeeping troops. It has always occurred in Congolese history, in different points in Congolese history. So when you look at the DRC, it is important to understand that civilian protection is essentially a political issue.
Like you point out, this has been going on for decades in the DRC. Mm. But were this latest wave of violent protests against the UN, you know, these anti-UN sentiments whipped up by a lot of online messages?
Yes, whipped up by online messages. It's whipped up. Some of it is whipped up by members of Tshisekedi's alliance. Some of it is whipped up by opponents of Tshisekedi, right, from the FCC, who are loyal to the former president. So it's the lack of civilian protection and the perceived failure of the UN peacekeepers becomes a political issue that all elements of the political divides in the DRC mobilize for political purposes.
What about the police there? What are they doing in response to these violent protests?
Well, one of the things that we have to understand is that the Congolese government establishing control over the country has always been a problem for successive Congolese governments, right? Outside the immediate environs of Kinshasa, you basically have no state control. And state control becomes less and less and less the farther away you move from the capital. So you have a situation where you have these civilians who do not trust their police and their military and think that the UN deployments are ineffective and basically feel that they're essentially at the mercy of these groups that are supported by foreign countries.
That was Paul Nanutilia, a research specialist with the African Center for Strategic Studies and a former elections observer in the DRC. He was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam, in Washington. Activists in Malawi suspended planned anti-government protests following the abduction last night of one of the organizers. A witness says a man grabbed Sylvester Namiwa as he was leaving a news conference, pushed him into a car, and drove away. Malawi's president has condemned the abduction, and police say they are investigating. Lameck Masina reports from Blantyre, Malawi.
The planned protests were aimed at pushing President Lazarus Chakwera give up his immunity from prosecution and also limit his presidential powers, as he promised during the last campaign. Mundangu Nyirenda, is a member of the Center for Democracy and Economic Development Initiatives, who CDED, which organized and then suspended the demonstrations.
We did that out of respect for Namiwa, because we don't know where he is, then how can we be able to demonstrate when we don't know where he is? And we don't know what has happened to him. Maybe they have killed him, you know? So we decided to cancel it.
Edwin Maluka, who is CDED's spokesman, says he witnessed the abduction. He says five men seized Namiwa from his car as he was leaving a press conference on the protest.
His car was blocked by a vehicle that had no registration number. And when he stopped to avoid hitting that vehicle in front of him, immediately some bouncers, could be more than five, came out of the vehicle and surrounded Mr. Namiwa's vehicle and started to force the doors open and pulled out him out of the car and started to beat him. And then they took him into their car and sped away.
Mauluka says attempts to chase the vehicle proved futile. Rights campaigners say the abduction was an attempt by Malawi's government to silence dissenting views. However, Malawi's Minister of Homeland Security told lawmakers Thursday that she believes Namiwa's disappearance was a ploy by opposition parties to tarnish the government's image. A government spokesman, Gospel Kazako, said the government had nothing to do with the incident. Speaking to a local radio station Thursday, he said the government cannot condone acts of hooliganism.
There's no way this government can do that. Remember that we are not afraid of our critics. In fact, we look at our critics as part of the fertilization mechanisms for us to move forward. These are people that are acting as a mirror. These are the people that will always remind us on what we should be doing.
President Chakwera on Thursday condemned the abduction and called for a speedy investigation into the matter. Halina Mwanza, deputy spokesperson for Malawi Police Service, said the police are doing just that.
We can't disclose when are we going to conclude our investigations or what we have maybe found at this time. The only statement we can say is that we are investigating into the matter.
Meanwhile, despite the cancellation of demonstrations in the capital, Lilongwe, protests went forward in other areas where police fired tear gas to disperse people who allegedly wanted to loot shops and vandalize property. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. U.S. Ambassador to Libya Richard Norland has again sought to mediate between Libya's rival prime ministers Abdulhamid al-Dabiba of the Tripoli-based Government of National Unity and Fathi Bashagha, who was named by the East-based parliament to end the tensions that have led to fresh clashes in the North African country. He said the issue of legitimacy is fundamental to disagreements between the parties and that they only can be resolved through the long-delayed elections. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi asked Wolfgang Porschnei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, about the prospects of Norland's success in mediating those disagreements.
As it was before, next to nil. There is really no way to organize elections under the current circumstances with a prime minister, namely Dabeba, who rejects the election laws issued by the parliament, the House of Representatives, and on the other side, a parliament, the House of Representatives, which rejects the prime minister. So there is simply no common ground between them. Currently, there is also absolutely no need for Dabeba to seek a compromise or to hand over to Fathi Bashagha, as Dabeba is currently firmly in charge. Oil imports are increasing. This means Dabeba has full access to the oil revenues with the appointment of a new chairman of the National Oil Corporation. Several of the most powerful Tripoli militias are protecting him from Bashagha and his allies, although those who are protecting Dabeba are also on odds with each other, as the recent fighting in Tripoli has clearly demonstrated. The situation in Tripoli is currently extremely tense anyway, between the broader Labour constitution and election support force and Osamashvili's forces of the so-called Libyan Army Western Military Region. We could see some fierce fighting in the next weeks, and maybe this could also decide about the power struggle between the Labour and Bashar.
The military commission 5+5 had met in an effort to unify the Libyan armed forces. Does that give you an optimistic perception of a possible reconciliation between East and West in Libya?
Not really. In Western Libya, there is a Libyan army almost only by name. It consists of a Ministry of Defense. The Minister of Defense is in a double function, Prime Minister Dabeiba, of several staffs and headquarters for brigades, some military schools and academies. Troops really loyal and subordinated directly to Lieutenant General Mohammed al-Haddad, the Chief of General Staff of the Libyan Army, number at best between 2,500 and 3,000 troops. That's not a lot. Most of the militias in Western Libya are considered part of the Ministry of Defense or of the Ministry of the Interior and are also getting paid through them, but they operate entirely independent. I would rule out that the core units of the most important militias, of the militias of Operation Volcano of Rage, who defended Tripoli against Khalifa Haftar's Libyan National Army, are willing to unite with the Libyan National Army. Maybe there is some kind of symbolic common supreme command or something like this. But the real reconciliation and unification will not be the case anytime soon. And I don't see a reason why in this reconciliation, struggle for reconciliation, Libya should be the exception. I don't know any country where 2 years after the last shot was fired in the major civil war, armies of the former warring factions are getting reunified. This is simply not realistic.
That was Wolfgang Poschtei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Political parties in Senegal are finishing preparations for legislative elections on Sunday. The vote pits the ruling party coalition Beno Bokyakar, or United in Hope, against opposition group Yawi Askin We, or Liberate the People. Reuters notes that President Macky Sall's Beno Bokyakar could lose its majority in parliament, where it now holds 125 out of 165 seats. The elections come amid popular dissatisfaction with growing unemployment and inflation, now expected to reach over 5% this year. The government boasts of its focus on infrastructure projects, including high-speed rail, improvements in the production of gas and oil, and also in electricity and rural development. Critics say most of the improvements benefit the wealthy and well-connected. They say Sall has also jailed his main competitors on corruption charges. Reuters reports that violent protests took place last month after the opposition legislative list of the vote was disqualified on technical grounds. The president has been in power since 2012 and has promised to serve only 2 terms. Democracy activists fear he could break that promise and run again in 2024. Observers say the opposition is popular among young people and won over major cities in elections last January. The youngest brother of the late head of state of Burkina Faso, Thomas Sankara, says former President Blaise Compaoré should have submitted to justice before asking for forgiveness. Compaoré, then a close friend of Sankara, led a coup in 1987, during which Sankara was assassinated. Compaoré went on to rule Burkina Faso for 27 years. A military court earlier this year found Compaoré complicit in the assassination of Sankara and sentenced him to life in absentia. On Tuesday, Compaoré apologized to all Burkinabe and the Sankara family for, in his words, all the acts I may have committed during my tenure. Daybreak host James Batty spoke with Paul Sankara, the younger brother of the late Sankara, who says his family is not against forgiveness or reconciliation, but Compaoré must first respect the military court's decision.
No, it's a couple of things. The first one is we need to respect one of the strongest foundations of the nations, which is the justice. After 34 years, Thomas Sankara's assassination, and we had a justice last year, and the verdict has been done by the justice. The best way for him would have been to respond to the justice. But the second level, this letter that has been released recently from Blaise Compaoré asking forgiveness, no one cannot give me the evidence, the proof that it comes from him. And you can't send your daughter and an Ivorian minister to read and ask for forgiveness. Is it still Ivorian or is Burkina there? I don't know what, it's blurry. So that's exactly the first thing I need to say. We not against any reconciliation process or forgiveness or unity of the nation. No, how we do it, that's the point.
So, Paul, former President Compaoré was found guilty, and then he was sentenced. But we noticed that earlier this year he returned to Burkina Faso. What do you make of the fact that he returned, and how come did they not hold him to serve the sentence? Is there some kind of relationship between him and the military junta there?
It shows exactly how things are not honest and true. That's a good evidence. Who had the initiative to send him from Ivory Coast to Burkina? One. Second, the current government in Burkina Faso, military that came in power through military coup, accepted. I don't know where they're trying to go with this approach. Or it means some people or some families are above the law. There's something wrong here. And the popular, it is a justice for all of us or justice for some of us. We're not against the forgiveness and the reconciliation, not at all in unity. But let's figure out how we're going to do it in a strong way in order to avoid repeating the same mistake.
Former President Compaoré is asking for forgiveness. Although you have mentioned several steps that you think he should have taken, let's assume he takes those steps. Will you or your family be able to forgive him?
It's a question of different consideration in order to give you a correct answer. Not just Sankara's family, but other victims. Those families have certain custom and tradition. You have to get the point of view of different members of the families. After 37 years, families were dismantled in Burkina, out of Burkina, out of Africa, Europe and the U.S.
That was Paul Sankara, the younger brother of the late head of state of Burkina Faso, Thomas Sankara, speaking with Daybreak's James Butty. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays,